It's hello from me.
And it's hello from him.
Yes, I'm Barry Milnes. He's Barry Cowan. And together we are the Two Barrys, welcoming you to the first episode of our Tennis Takeaway podcast. For those of you who've heard us commentating together on Sky Sports tennis coverage in Britain over the last 17 seasons, well, thanks for joining us again in this new venture. And for those of you wondering just who on earth we are, well, I've been a tennis reporter and commentator since 1990, while he's a former British Davis Cup player, now long established as a leading broadcaster and pundit on tennis. So, Bazza, what's the Tennis Takeaway going to offer?
Well, Barry, we will have in-depth interviews with high-profile figures, not just in tennis, but who are also known to be big fans of the sport. And each week we'll be joined by a guest broadcaster who covers the sport. And this week we are delighted we have the Australian journalist, Peter Mercato, direct from Melbourne. Peter, who is working for the Australian Open Radio, Channel 9, and many others. Peter, welcome. And overnight, the surprise announcement from Andy Murray that this will be his last year on tour. What did you make of it over there in Australia?
Well, I guess we're all as surprised as what you are over there, really. That was 11 o'clock press conference in the morning, which was a bit unusual, and we thought that maybe he was going to pull out of just playing the Australian Open and take a little bit of extra time to get right. But when he first walked into the room and started getting emotional, then we sort of got a sense of sort of the struggle. We've had a feeling, an inkling about what the struggle's been like, but that sort of brought it home to everyone. And then had to leave the press conference room. He came back shortly after and made the announcement. He said, look, you know, it's very hard to keep going like this when he can't even put his shoes and socks on without feeling pain. So I think the intention is to try and get to Wimbledon, but, you know, he's left the door open to saying, well, maybe this could be his last tournament. He's got Roberto Bautista Agut first up. That'll be on Monday in Melbourne. And it's going to be a very sad farewell because he, of all the players, is fondly loved, respected, all of those sort of things, and for the work he's done here and around the world.
So it wasn't a case that the press pushed Murray. He volunteered that news, did he?
Yes, because the first question was that the meeting broke down was, how are you? It was just as simple as that. You know, how's the injury? How's everything going? And, you know, he said, not great. And obviously that gave us a sense of what was to come. But, you know, I think the rest of it in terms of, you know, finding it hard to keep going on and that sort of thing, it was obviously very heartfelt. You got the sense that he wanted to just get that off his chest. He wanted to talk about it. He wanted to put it out there in the open, what the struggle has actually been. And I think there was a genuine sympathy. There's genuine sadness, not just from the journalists in the room, but all the players have been talking about it around here over the past 24 hours. And yeah, it's just really sad to see.
It really is, Peter. I think we'd all agree that really something that in the back of our minds we've kind of expected, because these hip injuries, these surgeries are very difficult to come back from. And the way he hobbled out of Wimbledon in that quarterfinal loss a couple of years ago, you kind of wondered then, did we not, that it could be the case that this would be the end game?
Well, yeah, I think so. And the fact that you know, it's been such a long struggle to get back as well. And Baz, obviously, you know him pretty well. You know the struggles that have been going on behind the scenes to just try and get back out there. He's such a competitor. He wanted to get back out there. He wants to get back out there and play his best too, but he also realises that that's probably not possible. And then the quality of life in retirement too, to be able to run around with the kids and do all those things as well, I think was weighing heavily too.
But he still thinks like a world number one, because that was his ranking at Wimbledon back in 2017 when the hip injury first was a real issue for all of us. I think he's been managing it the 2 years or 3 years before that. So he has had a very difficult time. But the positive news was in November. He had 6 weeks in Philadelphia with Bill Knowles, but he sort of dropped it in, didn't he, a couple of weeks ago, saying, I am in pain. He absolutely deserves the right to walk out on centre court one more time. And that I'd love to be able to see.
Hear, hear. I mean, what fantastic memories he's given us over the years. Those two Wimbledon titles, the first, of course, in 2013, after he'd won the US Open title the year before. Two Olympic gold medals in the singles. The Davis Cup title of 2015, leading the team And he has been, Barry, a great team player, hasn't he? A great mentor to those coming up behind him, trying to follow in his giant footsteps. And he's been a mentor far and wide, not just to the guys on the Davis Cup team, but also to the women players as well. He's a great proponent of women's tennis and all the issues they faced.
Yeah, and that, I'm sure, will be something that Andy will like to do post his professional tennis career. Of course, he's got his own management company. He represents some players already, male and female. I think for Andy that he obviously won't be short of offers, but nothing will replicate when you have been right at the top of your sport. Nothing will replicate getting out there and playing in that intense environment. So it will have a period of adjustment, but I'm sure that come the right time that we will see him back. Potentially, maybe even Davis Cup captain would be nice, wouldn't it, for Great Britain?
That would be huge. And I think my personal experience of dealing with him, he's always been great to deal with. He's been through some difficult matches, had some difficult results, and yet, you know, he's honoured commitments to talk when he's agreed to do so. He's always given considered answers to decent questions. And I think, you know, I'm looking forward, dare I say it, once he finally has to hang up the racket, that we will still have him in the sport in some way or other, and maybe even in the commentary box. And of course, that very dry humour that he's got. But he's great fun behind the scenes, believe it or not. And we just wish him well, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I'll never forget that 2013 Wimbledon win. Like the drama, everything surrounding it, the build-up, and then the reaction when he won. It was just extraordinary. And that moment alone would have made him a great, but the fact he's done so much else for the sport and his own personal achievements put him well above that too.
Well, Andy was a five-time finalist at the Australian Open. Yes, he is in the draw, so we can't say that that's the sum total of what he'll achieve, but it now seems highly unlikely. But as to the draw, guys, well, let's actually look at the women's first, because, I mean, that very top quarter is sensational with a number of big names there, Peter.
Absolutely. Simona Halep is the top seed, only played the one match in Sydney, losing to Ash Barty, comes in without a coach, not employing a coach for a little while. Kai Kanepi, the first opponent. That's going to be really tough first up. Manages to get through that, potentially Venus Williams in that quarter, and also Serena Williams as well. I mean, that as a quarter is just going to be sensational in what is a very, very even women's draw.
And Barry, if you look into the bottom half, another section which really leaps off the page of the draw, you've got Maria Sharapova and also Caroline Wozniacki in a very close bracket to one another, as well as the Aussie hope Ash Barty.
Yeah, both Sharapova and Wozniacki, of course, had problems injury-wise, so they are not necessarily going into the Australian Open 100% fit. And it is such a wonderful opportunity for anyone. And don't forget, you know, also is Naomi Osaka in the draw as well, because she won the US Open. So as of has been the case the last few years, it is wide, wide, wide open. And it's whoever literally can play their best tennis. If they can get through that first week, play their best tennis the last three or four matches.
And then we turn to the men's draw, guys. And Peter, I mean, what do the Aussies make of the fact that Nick Kyrgios is unseeded and he's taking on Milos Raonic in the first round for the right to face either Stan Wawrinka or Ernest Gulbis in the second round?
Oh, I don't think we're all terribly surprised considering what Nick can produce at times and his own struggles to find that motivation out on the court. And it's going to be a tough one against Milos Raonic, but the thing is, Nick doesn't necessarily need a lot of matches to be at top form because he's just got that natural talent anyway, and that's what makes it a tricky contest. Stan Wawrinka is going to be tough in the next round too, and potentially Alexander Zverev in that particular quarter of the draw. So, look, it's a blockbuster. I would say it's going to be on Rod Laver Arena, but I'd only be guessing for that. But boy, there's some interesting matchups coming up in the opening round.
Don't need to reduce it to 16 seeds. 32 seeds is good enough. And thankfully, they came to their senses because they were threatening to do that, weren't they, a year ago?
Yeah, they absolutely were. And the fact that they've kept it at 32, I think, give that seeding protection. Everything's fairly even anyway. And you've got those good players who are unseeded who might cause some trouble. So I think it's fairly even, whichever way you look at it.
Well, somebody else who regularly attends the Australian Open, like Peter, and indeed no doubt has enjoyed watching Andy Murray perform there valiantly over many years, is the Wimbledon chairman, Philip Brook. A few months ago, he announced that this will be his final year at the helm of the All England Club. And so just before the new year, I paid him a visit there to talk about his tenure as chairman. And I began by asking him what the major challenges have been since he took charge back in 2010.
Funnily enough, I think the biggest challenge is actually a growing challenge, in that if I look back 8 years back then, the world of tennis was a relatively calm place, and what we've seen in recent years has been quite a lot of turmoil, quite a lot of change, and Wimbledon is one of, I suppose, seven major stakeholders in the sport, does what it can to try and influence change, but we don't decide, and there are things that have happened and are continuing to happen that are, I think, quite difficult and challenging for tennis. And so we at Wimbledon have spent, myself and Richard Lewis, my chief executive, our chief executive, have spent more time on world tennis matters over the last two or three years than ever.
Challenges are plenty, but in terms of achievements and what you sort of set out to do, what you look back on with great pride, justifiably.
Looking back 8 years, one of the early achievements, I think, under my leadership was the creation of the three-week gap. So, as we all know, historically, Roland Garros finished, and then 2 weeks later, we were into Wimbledon, and there were just 2 weeks, all very sort of condensed and not really enough time for players to recover properly and prepare thoroughly on a different surface on grass. After a long period of consultation, it was in 2012 that we announced that we would make the change. And so 3 years later, from 2015, the three-week period was created, and it meant a reshuffling of the dates of other tournaments as well, not just Wimbledon. Wimbledon moved back 1 week, but also Queens and Edgbaston, which had previously been straight after Roland Garros, they moved into the middle of the 3 weeks, so they had a better week, as did Halle in Germany for the men. And new tournaments were created around it. We've now had 4 years of a three-week gap, and I would say each year it's got a little bit better as we've worked and continue to work on improving that period of preparation. And I think now it's in a pretty good place.
Well, certainly. In 2019, obviously going into this year's championships, your final one in charge as chairman, the new Court One roof will have been installed. You will have tested it out earlier in the spring, but also fifth set tie breaks. I mean, these are other developments that have taken over Grand Slam tennis, it seems. Everyone's going for some version or other of it. Your thoughts on what you've got lined up for this year?
Obviously, it's a very important year, as you say. The number one court project finishes this year. We have a test event on the 19th of May to test the retractable roof and all of the air handling equipment with a capacity crowd within the bowl. So a major step. We've learnt a lot from the centre court roof. It will be 10 years old in 2019, and it's proved to be a major benefit to us. Funnily enough, even on sunny days, it helps us potentially complete the schedule. It means that people coming to Wimbledon with a ticket for Centre Court have known they're going to see live tennis, and also, very importantly for our broadcast partners, they've known that there will always be some live tennis to televise. So that's been a very big project for us.
And Kevin Anderson, John Isner, those kind of guys, what tennis they played for us in 2018, but that was the final straw?
Well, it made for an interesting couple of meetings here in the autumn afterwards, because I think what we saw was a fantastic tennis match. In fact, there were two fantastic semi-finals. It wasn't just theirs. But I think what we saw with Kevin Anderson was that match and the previous match with Federer, 13-11 in the fifth, by the time he got to the final, he was tired. He was very tired, and he put up a great show, but I think, you know what, it would have been a better final, I think, if he'd had a bit less tennis to play during those two matches. So we thought long and hard about it, and what we hope we've come up with in terms of a 12-all tiebreak in the final set is a good compromise between the advantage set, final set that we've always had, and actually finding a place where the players know that there is an end to the match. Because if you don't know when the match is going to end, it's actually quite hard, I think, for players, and many players have said this to us, it's hard for them to manage their own, you know, reserves of energy, etc., because they just don't know how much longer they're going to be playing for. And it was really quite disruptive, to be honest, in the 2018 championships. It did mean we had one semi-final held over to the following day for part of the match, and it also meant a delay in the ladies' final that subsequent day as well. So we learnt a lot, and hopefully it'll be a good solution for 2019 and beyond.
Another big announcement recently was, of course, your purchase of the Wimbledon Park Golf Club over the road, over Church Road here. So the area that that is going to open up to the club in the years to come is extensive. Just talk a bit about that and what the plans are for Wimbledon's future in that regard.
The All England Club has owned the freehold to that land now for the past 25 years, and the golf club and its members have been the tenants. And the lease has or had 23 years left to run. And so what has happened as a result of this acquisition is that the lease effectively has been shortened. So instead of having 23 years to run, the lease will come to an end in the next 3 to 4 or 5 years. There's a slight transition period over for part of the golf course. So what it means is that in a few years' time, the All England Club will have the opportunity to use all of that land for the benefit primarily of the championships. We've had a long-term ambition to bring Wimbledon qualifying on site, so to speak. We're the only Grand Slam where the qualifying event takes place away from the main site, and it, you know, paradoxically, most of the people who play in Wimbledon qualifying lose and therefore don't step inside the grounds of SW19. So we think that's a shame and something we'd like to change. So Wimbledon qualifying in years to come, I think very likely to be part of the plan there. But it's a big piece of land. It's about 80 acres of land. We are currently 40 acres to the west of Church Road. And so if you sort of closed your eyes and imagined 10 or 15 years out from now, imagine that Church Road will always be there, but imagine it was either sunk or somehow you bridged over it. It was bridged over. This won't be in my time, obviously, but and imagine it being one site rather than two, with a secure boundary at the edge of the site. And then I think you can start to imagine how we could make the queuing experience, as an example, so much better. At the moment, we rush it because we only have a week to do it, because we don't have the land all year round. In the future, we can build permanent queuing facilities into the grounds. You could imagine increased ground capacity. You could imagine a second Henman Hill, for example, something like that, another area where people could come into the grounds. And there may be some championship courts over there, don't know. We are very respectful of the heritage of that piece of land, and therefore whatever we do, we will do, obviously, with the agreement of Merton Council, but we would like to do it very much in sympathy with the park and its heritage and to be good neighbours.
Whilst Wimbledon thrives on its traditions, and it's absolutely central to the sort of the belief about how this place should be run and how you have run it, do you think there's a case, though, for perhaps updating the ballot system? It to some people is a very antiquated way, because people can't specifically say, you know, choose the tickets they want. They're kind of balloted, they get what they're given kind of thing, and that can sometimes create difficulties for them in their own calendar. So if you were trying to give better supply to the massive demand there is, would you perhaps think of in the future it will be changed?
I think it's a really good question. If you look at the current ballot system and you said, you know, why on earth would a modern, forward-thinking, forward-looking organisation like Wimbledon, why on earth would they have a system like that for people? It is hard work. You have to send in, you know, a form with a stamped address envelope to get a form to then fill it in to send it back. We have, for the last 3 or 4 years now, put our overseas ballot online, almost as a bit of a test, really, to see what happens. And it's been interesting and successful. And we're not making decisions at the moment, but we are looking closely at the whole question of the ballot, whether and when and how we might move it online sometime. The reason for not having done this sooner, honestly, is that we are a bit worried about two things. One is that we might just be completely swamped with demand, and therefore the chances of people being successful in the ballot will go down potentially quite significantly. And secondly, we think it is, with a paper-based system, it's harder for people to cheat, if I can put it like that. And so going online, it might be a bit easier for people to do multiple things and harder for us to spot them. And obviously we want to try and be as fair as we can to everybody.
let's pause it there and get some of your thoughts on what Philip said.
Well, Philip certainly said a lot, but one thing that really stuck out for me was the golf club and fantastic news before Christmas that they've now been able to take over the golf club over the road, and they will go from 40 acres to 120 acres. So the next two or three years, or even four, five, six, 7 years, the All England club got to decide how best to use that extra 80 acres.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they actually do it, but it's going to be great to have the qualifying event down there on site rather than at Roehampton. It'll just bring everything together nicely and neatly. The thing you should point out is that it's not going to be a one-year sort of process. This is going to take many years to roll through, but it's an exciting development. A lot of talk about the tiebreakers, obviously at the Australian Open, working with tiebreakers as well, a slightly different format than what Wimbledon has, what the US Open has, French just doing their own thing and still having the advantage sets. And the idea of the ballots and finding maybe better ways to improve the queuing situation or what to do with the ballot system, if is there another way to go about it. Look, there's been some great innovations and there's room for a bit more. We're going to see it with the golf club and then some of these other sort of traditions as well, whether they'll change in the future.
Yeah, I like the idea that they're going to keep the queue because I think that does bring people, tennis fans, together in a way that doesn't happen at any other event. And great stories come out of that year after year. But I do think that the ballot, personally, I think it's frustrating. I know a lot of people who would love to be able to just say, well, I want to try and get a ticket on that day. And to go into the ballot, a lot of people say, I never get anything out of it. I think they are looking, obviously, as Philip said, at new ways perhaps to do it. And I would encourage that.
Yeah, certainly with the technology available as well. With the queuing, maybe that might be different because if you've got an expanded site, you can obviously fit more people in. So there may not be as much of a need to have the queue if you can fit more people in the first place. But obviously that's down the track.
Well, you're listening to the Two Barrys Tennis Takeaway, the first instalment of a new venture, which we'll be producing regularly for all the main podcast platforms. Time to return now to our opening interview with the Wimbledon chairman, Philip Brook.
I've been lucky enough to come here many, many years and it has changed significantly and yet it has that feel of remaining the same. And to do that, you have to obviously take control of how it is presented, Philip. Brand is very important to Wimbledon.
Brand is absolutely at the heart of everything that we do. And I've made it my sort of personal mission and that of Richard Lewis also to, in a sense, be as best we can, the guardians of the brand, the caretakers of the brand. And what does that mean? It means that when people come to Wimbledon and they look at how our grounds are presented and the way we go about doing things, that they would recognise that they're at Wimbledon and they're not somewhere else. So, number one court stadium, when it's finished next summer, I think when people look at that, if you took a photograph of it and said, where is this stadium and what does it represent? I think people would say that is Wimbledon and it's tennis because it looks like it belongs here. It is green. It has purple in the floral displays. Another example I could give you is that 4 years ago, we insourced our retail operations. So until that time, all of our retail was outsourced and the outsourcing organisation did everything. They decided what we sold, where it was made, at what price it was sold, etc. And we changed the whole process, recruited an experienced retail executive to lead the team, and now we recruit 300 members of staff to look after our shops during the championships. We decide what products are sold, the look and feel of all of them, the quality of them, where they're sourced from, etc. It's a really good example of us taking control of our brand, I think.
People have come to Centre Court for many, many years and enjoyed seeing who's in the royal box, but you've made that something even greater than it was before, have you not?
Well, that's very nice of you to say so. I don't know. I when I took the role on, I thought I wanted to make it a bit more interesting, but without turning it into a place where celebrities come and it is a fine line to walk because it would be very easy to have more celebrities in the royal box and therefore I think we could then rightly be accused of being too celebrity focused. So finding that balance is tricky. More emphasis on sport. There'll be more sports people come to Wimbledon over recent years, and that's been obviously tennis people, the tennis family, but also other sport. I think the Sporty Saturday that we've had for quite a while now has become a little bit of a tradition of Wimbledon. We've had some marvellous moments. I remember in 2013 when on that Saturday we had gold medal winners from the Olympic Games the previous year here in London, and that was a very special day to be here. But also we're very blessed with our relationship with the royal family. The royal family have been great supporters of our championships. The Duke of Kent attended his 50th championship this year as our president, and we're very grateful for all that he's done for us over the years. And then for the last 2 years, as the Queen stepped down as our patron, the Duchess of Cambridge has now stepped into that role. She's interested in tennis, wants to do more, and I'm sure we'll see more and more of her in years to come.
Right at the start of the interview, you touched on the fact that it's become a more complex place now, professional tennis. And certainly in 2018, some big developments. I mean, the continuation of the Laver Cup getting stronger and stronger. The Davis Cup now taking this very different route for the tournament that has got such a great history. And hot on the heels of that, the announcement of the ATP Cup that this time, you know, next year will be have taken place. So for you, what are your main concerns? What are your main thoughts on where the sport is and where it has to somehow find a way to go?
I think you've articulated the challenge rather well there, Barry. It makes no sense, does it? It makes no sense organising tennis's calendar in the way that tennis is going about organising it. And I think nobody disagrees. So you can talk with each of the people involved in the organisation of the Laver Cup or the Davis Cup or now the ATP Cup, and all of them would agree that there are now too many team events for men in the calendar. They would certainly agree that it makes no sense having Davis Cup at the end of November and ATP Cup in the first week of January, literally 5 weeks apart. And probably both tournaments won't do very well. Both events won't do very well because of it. But actually, what seems to be missing is enough goodwill in the system to enable that to change. And it's a strange word, and it's a result of tennis not being, there isn't a governing body for the sport. That is at the root of this problem. And so there are seven, people talk about the seven stakeholders being the four Grand Slams, ATP, WTA and the ITF. And those seven organisations operate to some extent independently or largely independently of each other. And so they are capable and have made decisions that suit them, that don't suit other people. And that's the issue we faced.
If you were offered the opportunity to take over a new governing body of the whole sport, Philip, would you take it?
I'm not sure that opportunity will ever exist. So, but what it needs is, it needs something like that. It needs a coming together of the stakeholders in tennis to say, okay, it's better for the sport as a whole, for some of the things that are at the heart of the sport to be owned by everybody and not by individual parts of it. So the calendar is probably the best example, but the ranking system would also be right up there as well. It cannot be right that Davis Cup, the new Davis Cup, will not have ranking points, and yet this new tournament that is part owned by ATP 5 weeks later will. And the reason that one will and Davis Cup won't is because of who owns the ranking system, and that is a nonsense, I think.
So finally, one more year to go for you in the role. What have you enjoyed the very most about that in the time you've been here, and what are you looking forward the most to doing away from Wimbledon after you step down?
What have I enjoyed the most? I would have to say, I'd have to start with the people. I think one of my greatest achievements as chairman was the recruitment of Richard Lewis. He's been a brilliant and outstanding chief executive in every respect, and he's made my job a lot easier because of that. I have 100% trust in Richard, and under his leadership, he has created a superb, experienced team of executives and staff working for him. So we have that, and then on the volunteer side of things, our committee put in countless hours, week in, week out, year in, year out, also trying to do their best for the club and the championships. On a personal level, I've enjoyed having the opportunity, and it's by chance, but having the opportunity to be in the role, seeing a British man win Wimbledon twice, with Andy Murray's wins in 2013 and 2016. That was, particularly the 2013 one against Djokovic, that was an outstanding piece of tennis history, wasn't it, for all of us? So, I've had the opportunity to meet, we touched upon it earlier, a lot of very interesting people over the last 8 years. And what was the last part of your question?
What are you looking forward to doing when you step down?
What am I looking forward to doing when I step down? I actually haven't given a huge amount of thought to it as yet. I need to, because it will be a big change, and it is coming around the corner. But there's still a lot to do during 2019, so I need to remain focused on that. But yeah, more time with the family for sure. I'd like to improve my golf. I'd like to get a bit fitter. And I'll probably do some other things. I think the experience of being in this role means you come out of it with a lot of knowledge, experience of running a relatively complicated organization. And for sure, I've got some skills and experience that I'd like to think could be put to good use somewhere else.
So I'm sure they will be. But Philip Brook, thank you very much for talking to us.
Barry, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I've got the perfect solution. Rip up the calendar, start again. And the first thing you'll have to do, Peter, is move the Australian to March. But of course, in reality, that is never going to happen. And that's why it's been so difficult to actually come up with the right plan.
Look, there's a number of different issues with that. I agree with you, Baz. If we could just rip it all up and start it, if we could actually bring all the tours together and just have one united tour, it would be fantastic, and everyone working together. Again, I don't see that happening in the near future. It's never going to move from January, the Australian Open, because it's school holiday time, it's summertime. It's got its place in the calendar. But the ATP Cup, when it comes in across the other capital cities, will provide a nice sort of lead-in as well. But yeah, it's frustrating that we can't get it all together and that the season is as long as it is. But, you know, maybe one day, maybe a long time down the track, we might be able to see a bit of common ground.
Well, we also have a website, thetwobarrys.com, which will run in conjunction with the podcast. And that's where you can catch up with all the interviews we do, including one already in the can with my former tennis coach, David Samuel, who talked to me about the off-season, its importance, how it's developed over the years, and how to do it right. Here's a brief taster.
When you've had a long season, the body does need to recover. But I think equally important, the mind needs to recover. You know, and I think when people go on holiday, I'd say there's got to be a minimum of a two-week break before you come from a season into an off-season. And if, you know, ideally you can, you know, if you can take 3 weeks, that's even better, depending on when your season finishes, so that the mind is eager, fresh. And also, you know, players by that stage, 2 or 3 weeks, start to miss the tennis a little bit. And the body, you know, hopefully, when they're on holiday, don't do absolutely nothing. You know, you have a little bit of active rest, you know, maybe if you do your yoga or whatever it is, you know, and just keep your body ticking over a little bit. You come into the off season with a rested body, and therefore you can start pushing it, you know, very hard in the early weeks of a preseason training, and the body can handle it. Because I think if you come in fatigued, you're probably going to get injured.
Well, interesting thoughts there from David, because every player is different in terms of how they go about their pre-season. Some like to take a longer break and maybe pick up the racket a little bit later. Some are itching to pick up a racket and start getting into training after a week of only being on holidays. So everyone is different, but it is highly important. It's this time of the year where you see the players, and this time of the year and also the end of the year, as to see how much gas they've got in the tank, as to how much work they've done and what they need to do for the upcoming season.
Peter, can I just say that I warn you now, I've had my best off-season ever, so look out when we rematch at the French Open.
I'm ready to go.
And I'm ready to umpire.
Well, I don't know who's going to tip whom for that one, but who are you guys tipping now for the singles titles at the Australian Open? Peter first.
For me, from the women's side, Angelique Kerber. Watched her at the Hopman Cup, and her preparation has been sensational. So I'm really liking the level of tennis she's bringing in a wide open draw. She, for me, is the standout player. And on the men's singles, I'm going to be pretty dull and boring and say Novak Djokovic is going to continue, even though he might have struggled a little bit at times in his matches early on to start off the season. I think he's going to hit his stride. He'll have some roadblocks along the way, but he should be able to get through and win the title.
A Brit hates to agree with an Aussie, but I'm afraid in both the women's and the men's, I'm going to have to go with what Peter McCarter has gone for. So Kerber and Djokovic. Please, Barry, you're not going to go with us, are you?
Maybe halfway. I'll go with Djokovic. But Federer could still be the man to watch out for. Having said that, in the women's, I'm going to go for Serena. Serena Williams to win it this time.
Good shout.
Yep, good thoughts.
Well, there you go. You've heard it on the Tennis Takeaway. And our next podcast will be on Monday, the 21st of January, in the heart of the Australian Open, when we'll be talking to someone who'll be among those challenging David Haggerty for the presidency of the ITF later this year, and also joined by our guest broadcaster, former player Jill Kravis. We also want you to contribute to the Tennis Takeaway. So if you have some broadcastable thoughts on the sport's current topics and any points raised in the interviews we do, well, please do contact us via the website, thetwobarrys.com, or by our Twitter handle, @thetwobarrys, and we'll do our very best to address them. Peter, thanks very much for joining us. Barry, thank you as well.
Thank you. Looking forward to hearing future episodes.
Enjoy the Australian Open.
Indeed, we all will. And thanks to you for listening. Bye for now.